Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Raymond Tungekar. Earlier this year, law enforcement officials with the MU Police Department announced that they had identified the person responsible for the homicide of Jiang H. Im, a retired faculty member with the university. Investigators were able to link the crime through an analysis of touch DNA, that's DNA left from skin cells. This type of genetic analysis is just one tool that crime scene investigators are using to link suspects to a crime. There's a certain allure to such crime scene investigations. What else could explain the immense popularity of the CSI television franchise? According to the firm Media Metrics, the original CSI was the most watched program in the world last year. But how accurate are these media depictions? Today on Intersection, we'll go behind the scenes and talk about how crime scene investigations are actually carried out. Joining me in studio to talk about this subject, Mike Himmel is a retired detective and adjunct instructor with Columbia College's Criminal Justice Program. Bill Marbaker is the Crime Lab Director for the Missouri State Highway Patrol. Tim Hall is the Director of Public Information and Education for the Missouri State Highway Patrol. And joining us by phone is Jeff Nichols. He's an adjunct instructor with the University of Missouri's Law Enforcement Training Institute. And he's also a retired Columbia Police Department detective. And we hope to hear from you in the audience as well. How accurate do you think programs like CSI actually are? Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also join our online chat by visiting kbia.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. To start out, why don't we just talk about how accurate these shows are? Shows like CSI, do they provide an accurate depiction of what crime scene investigations are like? Captain Hall, do you want to take that first?
Well, I think probably the first thing that varies in difference from how things are done in Missouri, or for as far as the patrol goes, is the fact that our laboratory and the analysts and criminalists don't go out to the scene most cases. They're actually in the laboratory conducting the analysis on the evidence that's submitted by the officers who are out in the field doing the investigation and collecting the evidence.
Okay, so there's an actual separation of duties. Who starts out? Who would actually go out to the crime scene and collect evidence? Would that be the detective?
Well, it depends on the protocol of the department. You would first have a first responder, uniformed personnel, and then according to whatever agency's protocol, how that progresses might be the on-call detective being called out. The on-call detective, in turn, would have the authority to, if it's within that person's capability, to work the scene or call out an evidence or a forensic unit. But the initial would be a first responder, then a detective notification, and then, according to whatever department protocol there is, an evidence unit being called out or personnel.
And who would actually assign the person that goes out originally, whether it's a detective or first responder?
Well, it's dispatched. First responders are dispatched. The detective may be who's in the office, could be who's on call. And then the like in Columbia, there's officers and detectives assigned to evidence, working crime scenes, and they would work scenes in a rotation.
Okay. And Jeff, does that correspond with your experience as well when you were working with the Columbia Police Department?
Absolutely. the call always comes in to the road officer, then it progresses from there.
Okay. And at what point, so the first responder or detective would go to the scene of the crime, and what happens then?
Well, usually they evaluate what the scene involves and what type of resources are needed at that point. They convey that to their supervisor. Then any specialty unit that is needed at that time is dispatched.
Okay. And at what point would the evidence, any evidence collected, be sent off to a crime lab?
Well, the evidence would be sent to the lab once the crime scene investigation is completed or sometimes partially completed, depending on the type of evidence that is needed to be looked at.
Okay, and typically what types of evidence are actually collected and looked at?
Well, that varies greatly. Usually the first evidence collected would involve obvious items, whether it be a weapon or cartridge cases that might be left behind, or it may be some blood evidence. So in a case where the suspect isn't known, it's critical that this evidence gets submitted to the lab as soon as possible for evaluation.
Okay, and once it's submitted, what happens then, Bill?
Well, once it's submitted to the lab, again, a lot of it depends on the nature of the crime. If it's a very serious crime, for example, homicide, we will want to sit down with the detectives, investigators, and actually discuss with them the individual items of evidence so that we can kind of get a little context to understand what needs to be done. One of the things we're lacking very frequently in our work is sufficient information to know what progressive types of analysis need to be made on things. You know, we might just get a sweater with no specific information. I remember years and years ago, a detective was telling me he was assisting a small agency, and they grabbed the sweater or jacket, said, "Here, send it to the lab." And he says, "What do you want me to have them do? Have it cleaned and pressed?" You know, so you know, I don't mean to be flip about that, but we really need information. Are you looking for suspect blood on this piece of article of clothing, or is this from the? Was this clothing worn by the suspect, and are we looking for association to a victim? So the first thing we'll do is meet with the investigators and try to get a more thorough understanding of the case and what the needs are of the case.
Okay. Would the director of a crime lab have any discretion in terms of suggesting possible tests to be performed?
Not necessarily. I normally do not get involved in at that level. You know, I'm managing a large lab system. We have supervisors and technical leaders in the various disciplines who are responsible for making those kinds of decisions. At the end of the day, it's really the case agent, the person in the lab who's assigned to that case, that makes the kinds of decisions with the input of perhaps their supervisor.
See, that may have been another area where the TV show CSI differ from the way things are actually done, because there's several different disciplines within our laboratory, and a lot of them do not cross over with you. You have your firearms section, you have your trace evidence, you have your drug section, and you have your DNA section. And a lot of times those criminalists don't do work in those other sections. So it may be that you have to have somebody from several different sections to work on one case, depending on what was involved in the crime and what was collected.
Okay. I just want to remind listeners that you're listening to Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about crime scene investigations and how they are carried out. Joining me in studio are Mike Himmel. He's an adjunct instructor at Columbia College. We also have Bill Marbaker, a crime lab director with the Missouri State Highway Patrol, and Captain Tim Hall, who's the director of public information and education for the Missouri State Highway Patrol. And joining us by phone, we have Jeff Nichols. He's an adjunct instructor with the University of Missouri's Law Enforcement Training Institute. And we'd like to hear from you in the audience as well. What questions do you have about the way crime scene investigations proceed? Give us a call at 573-882-8925, or you can email intersection@kbia.org. So has that type of separation of duties always been the case?
I will answer that. Generally so. The laboratory is staffed by scientific people who are trained in the biological or chemical sciences, and we are not necessarily trained in crime scene. That's pretty much the norm nationwide in crime labs. Many times you might see in the news, you might see a van that says crime lab going to a crime scene, but in many of those crime labs, other crime labs like Metropolitan Crime Labs, those really are not forensic scientists in there. Though the crime scene unit may just simply be administratively attached to the crime lab, but those may actually be sworn police officers going in and not the scientists themselves. So generally speaking, the laboratory people, with rare exception, we do go to crime scenes on occasion when it's a very, very unusual, complicated situation and do participate, but no more than a handful of times a year.
I think to expound upon that is from the evidence collection side, which is my expertise, is we conduct protocols that are in line with what the crime lab requires as far as handling, packaging, and we work with the crime lab to prioritize. We may collect one of the more a recent homicide I worked, I collected 75 pieces of evidence out of a car that was involved in a double homicide. I don't send down all 75 pieces of evidence. We would overwhelm the lab. We had discussion with the lab personnel, and we picked 12 of the hottest items that would, one, put suspect in car, stolen car from the victims. So we submitted 12, and if that didn't reach our objective, then we'd go on to the next pieces of evidence. So I think we haven't really touched on a step that the lab has protocols how they're going to handle evidence, but at the crime scenes, we're following protocols that we've been trained with using, say, the Highway Patrol Forensic Handbook Manual, and we do a lot of cross-training. Personnel from the lab will come out and take part in training exercises or training classes like at the University of Missouri, LETI, or at Columbia College, or in-service training that they'll all be part of. So we have an understanding how to prioritize our evidence and the capabilities of the lab when we submit that evidence. And we have a form that we fill out that we put in there what our expectation of that particular item is. Do we want it fingerprints? Do we want serology? Is it going to trace? Is it going to be tool marked? We'll direct it to them, and that helps in their decision making of where that's going to be assigned to within his lab.
Okay, and how is that collection prioritized, though? How do you decide, you know, what evidence to collect first and send out? And also, how has the protocols changed over the years?
Well, the bottom line is the old Locher principle: when two things come into contact, there's a transfer. So we have to put suspect with victim, suspect with scene, or victim with suspect, victim suspect car. So that can contain how we prioritize our evidence to be sent to the lab. That, you know, that's one of the main objectives. Let's say a handgun's involved, and there's tool marks we're going to need on the lands and grooves to identify it to a particular weapon. We would direct that to the proper assignment down at the Highway Patrol lab. So we do a lot of the decision making on the Highway Patrol paperwork of why we're sending it to them and what we want. And we've done briefings back and forth with the lab. I've talked to lab personnel while I've been at crime scenes to see what they think about this or that. So we have a really good working relationship in the field that we can have access to lab personnel through phone contact.
Okay. We actually have a question from our chat room. Who does the actual collection of evidence? Is it police investigators or scientists?
Well, in this area, we have evidence technicians that are specifically assigned and trained in those regards, and we respond to a crime scene. We work in teams, and we'll physically collect evidence and preserve it in such a manner to get it to the lab in its most pristine, you know, ability to do so. But we're actually trained in the actual collection, physical collection.
Okay. Well, let's go back to evidence collection. I mean, you mentioned a variety of different types. You have blood, serology, DNA. How much would actually need? I realize there's a variety in terms of what you collect and how much is needed, but typically, what is the minimum sample size to actually be effective?
Well, it depends.
I'll let you fill that.
It depends on what you want. First of all, I'd like to backtrack a little bit. You mentioned, like Mike was talking about processing the crime scene, you only have one chance to get it, so you get it all. And then you go back and you use your own experience and knowledge of, and maybe, you know, from your past experiences, to trying to determine what is the most probative, and that's the important operative word here, to determine what's the most probative piece of evidence. You know, Mike collects 1,000 items from the crime scene. He's not going to submit all 1,000 to the lab. You know, it's just, you know, logistically impossible. You know, he's got to pick the items that he thinks have the highest probability of success in associating, meeting the objectives of his investigation, if they are to associate a person to a scene, a person to a victim, et cetera, et cetera. So the minimum amount may just be one spot of blood or other biological stain, you know, on a shoe. You know, I remember a case one time where they had to look no further than a person's shoe to find the victim's blood, about the size, a drop the size, you know, of a, half of the size of a penny on the top of his shoe, and that matched the victim, and, you know, case closed. So they didn't have to test, you know, many other items of evidence. They just became, you know, just really unnecessary at that point. So they, to answer that simple question, you know, what's the minimum amount we need to test, there's no simple answer. We've had homicide cases that have been in active investigation for years, and we might be in the hundreds of items submitted to the laboratory as the agency keeps delving back into the case, reopening cold case investigations. So, you know, eventually, you know, they may hit upon the right piece of evidence, or the new technology evolves, as we're seeing today, that allows DNA analysis on items of evidence with sensitivities that we weren't even able to achieve 5 years ago.
Well, the technology is a key. I tell my students that the tools in their toolbox haven't even been invented yet. I mean, they're not even a thought. And, of course, a lot of them, you know, they've got to write papers or whatever. They, well, give us some examples. Well, when I started in 1975, when we recovered latent prints at a crime scene, we had them on a latent print card. We'd take them down to 1125 Locust in Kansas City to the ID section, hand those cards over to the ID section, and we'd say, check it with so-and-so, 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 and so-and-so. If that wasn't it, you were done. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, we have AFIS, Automatic Fingerprint Identification Systems. So that's a new tool, or not a new tool, but an example of a tool that in 1975 we didn't have. The other one, obvious one, is DNA. We did the first DNA case here in the state of Missouri, here in Columbia, in Boone County, with Ralph Davis versus the state of Missouri. And that was in, 86, 88, back in that time frame. But DNA was something that wasn't even a thought. And back when we were doing that, collecting for that, we didn't know how much of a sample they were going to need. So we stripped out the entire car, not even really understanding the DNA process. We just knew that there was some new technology out there and it might work. The other one's digital cameras. That's another thing. So the tools that these students or these officers will have when they start work today aren't even a thought. They're not even invented yet. We're not even talking about them yet, just like APHIS, DNA, digital cameras, that type of stuff.
Yeah. The new technology now that we're hearing about is field DNA analysis in the field, and that's evolving. A lot of the research is being driven by Department of Defense in their war on terror, and it's going to be trickling down into the law enforcement community. But
And what would that actually do, though? So, I mean, would it sequence DNA, or would it – I guess in terms of the analysis, what does it actually look at?
It's looking at the same core loci, we call them, that the FBI's CODIS database operates under. It's just they're trying to miniaturize all of the equipment, put it on it. They call it DNA on a chip. It's not ready yet. It's still an experimental stage. But like Mike said, in 10 years, it may be the norm. The investigator may be able to take a $20,000 machine to a crime lab, to a crime scene, and immediately root out 90% of the samples he might have had to collect, send to the crime lab right away. So, or develop a lead while the, excuse the pun, trail is hot on the suspect, and maybe solve the crime a lot faster that way.
Well, there's a great tool, and I think the Highway Patrol has them and are experimenting with them, is they have the mobile fingerprint scanners now. To where, say we've got a deceased along the side of the road, no identification, no idea. That could be several days of a process of trying to figure out who that person even is, which you got to know to really start an investigation. I mean, a good solid investigation. Well, now we have these hand scanners. We could put their finger on a scanner and get an APHIS hit. And I was using one at one of our training sessions. And of course, I'm in the system. It came back with an ID less than a minute. Of who I was. Of course, I'm in the system, that type of thing. But technology is a huge key, not only for instruments he has in his lab, but what we're using at crime scenes. It changes almost daily what we have available to us. We're applying more chemical and lab procedures, what used to be considered lab procedures, at crime scenes. We're applying chemicals that that were only available at the lab that we're using out at crime scenes, different types of chemicals to develop fingerprints you can't see with the naked eye, or bloody shoe prints, like with Luminol and Blue Star and that, those type of applications. We never had that in crime scenes. Now we do, that we can make those applications and can help us with our interpretations, reconstructions, and it goes on from there. So,
well, I do want to explore some of these emerging technologies in greater detail, but first I just want to remind listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Raymond Tongakar. Today we're pulling back the curtain and debunking some misconceptions about the way crime scene investigations are carried out. Joining me in studio are Mike Himmel of Columbia College, Captain Tim Hall, and Bill Marbaker of the Missouri State Highway Patrol, and joining us by phone is Jeff Nichols. He's an instructor with the MU Law Enforcement Training Institute. And for you and our audience, what questions do you have about evidence collection or analysis? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925. Email us at intersection@kbia.org, or you can tweet us at intersectkbia. We'd also like to remind you that Intersection is presented as streaming video during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at 2, online at kbia.org. You can also watch that video and join our online chat by going to kbia.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Again, that's Mondays at 2, online at kbia.org. So you earlier, Mike, you had mentioned just a variety of different technologies that have changed the way these investigations are carried out. How has this changed the level of the amount of time that's, you know, the speed at which a case is kind of investigated and convicted, perhaps?
Well, that's kind of difficult. It depends on the type of evidence we're collecting, the type of examinations we're requiring. That's really a tough one to try and put a solid answer on that. It's almost too broad.
Okay. Well, earlier you had also mentioned that, you know, there's a lot of chemical analysis being done now, you know, with Luminol to detect trace amounts of evidence. What does this mean in terms of actual instruction? Are people having to – are detectives and first responders required to perhaps be chemists or –
Well, what we're seeing now is since the NAS report, National Academy of Science report, came out, and along with these other commissions and committees being formed, is we're seeing that we're going back and training our students that are now in the process of getting their degrees, but we're also going back and doing in-service training, specialized training for law enforcement personnel already in the field, and we're basically going along the guidelines of the International Association of Identification. We're building classes that would assist them in getting certifications in forensic photography, blood stain reconstruction, as part of, and there's others, but as part of that, we're going back and retooling how we present training to our students because of all the hands-on applications we've got to teach now in the classroom versus how they'll apply them at crime scenes now.
Okay, and Jeff, how does it work out for law enforcement?
Well, Mike mentioned the National Academy of Science report, and that's a fairly interesting document. And I think that the conclusion of that essentially was summarized by saying that they support and promote the adoption of uniform, enforceable best practice, and that could also involve mandatory certification programs and accreditation programs. And, of course, the Highway Patrol Lab is an accredited entity through ASCLAD Lab. It also, I think, promotes training where you begin to transition into certification courses. And that's something that John Warden over at the Law Enforcement Training Institute was quite interested in when we began discussing the development of a certification crime scene program where students would be required ongoing credits in order to maintain a certification. And that certainly aligns with the National Academy of Science report.
Okay, and I do want to discuss just the implications of this report and this effort to standardize things, but let's talk about, you know, like, is there a crime, a type of crime that's almost impossible to solve, perhaps like a perfect homicide?
Well, I don't know. I only see what Mike brings. People like Mike bring to the labs. So he's the one that actually has to put the pieces together. We just give them pieces.
You know, there is no perfect crime. If you just go over the principle of when two items or two people come into contact, physical contact, there's going to be a transfer. You know, what we can do now with technology, and here's a good example. We collected a partial fingernail at a crime scene years ago. Nothing we could do with it back then. We're going back 15 years now, 18 years. Nothing we could do with that. Now, with the technology out there, we now know it's female. We now have been able to eliminate some suspects that were people of interest back then. As the technology changes, our capability changes. That's just the bottom line. And it's not going to stop. It's going to keep excelling, and we have to stay on the forefront. The lab has to do their part, staying technology-based, up-to-date, but we have to do our part at the crime scene side. And quite frankly, because of the types of evidence and the amounts of items of evidence we collect nowadays, we can overwhelm the lab. That's why we have to prioritize. Our evidence techs are far better trained, and we were talking off camera earlier in 1975 when I started doing evidence work in 75, 76, in that range. You were an evidence tech if you knew how to use a camera and powder for prints. There wasn't all this technology and the word forensics even being thrown around. So things have changed as technology changes.
I'd like to follow up on that. Sure. You know, what may seem like the perfect crime today, in 10 years, we'll have tools that didn't exist today. And perfect example is, currently the lab right now is actively involved in looking into two different homicides that occurred in the 1950s. Agencies are still reaching back into their archives and pulling cold cases out. Now, that goes back pretty far, and the likelihood of everybody being alive that might have been perpetrating those crimes is getting slimmer and slimmer now. But that's an example of where this is leading us. Right now, the fingerprint databases, and this is really what's driving a lot of this, is the APHIS fingerprint database, the CODIS DNA databases.
And what's CODIS?
Combined DNA Index System.
Okay.
It's a software program run by the FBI. All 50 states perform DNA analysis identically, and the data is exchanged among states and at the national level. So, as Mike mentioned, a piece of a fingernail could have had a few skin cells, from a victim that clawed the attacker that we could do nothing with 10 years ago. And we've had actual those scenarios occur in the last few years in the lab. And now we're able to recover the DNA from the few skin cells that were under the fingernail scrapings. And we upload those to CODIS, and we develop CODIS hits. And then the investigator gets a very interesting letter, and he goes out and interviews a suspect who thought he'd gotten away with a murder for the last 20 years.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to take a short break right now, but I just want to remind listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today, we're talking about crime scene investigations and hearing about some of the ways in which investigations have changed. Joining me in studio are Mike Himmel of Columbia College, Captain Tim Hull, and Bill Marbaker of the Missouri State Highway Patrol. And thank you to Jeff Nichols, who will be leading us after the break. He's an instructor with the MU Law Enforcement Training Institute. I'm Raymond Tongakar. We'll be back after a short break. Okay, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Raymond Tungekar. Today, we're talking about crime scene investigations and hearing about some of the ways investigations have changed over the years. Joining me in studio are Mike Himmel, an adjunct instructor in Columbia College's Criminal Justice Program. We're also joined by Captain Tim Hull and Bill Marbaker of the Missouri State Highway Patrol. And we also want to hear from you in our audience. What questions do you have about crime scene investigations? Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. So before the break, we were talking about some of these emerging technologies and how they're used to revisit unsolved cases. How often does that actually happen?
Well, I do a class at Columbia College, and it's a cold case class. I hate to call them cold cases. It's really... That was a media thing that caught on out in L.A. years ago, and it was a little issue. But what do you call these type of units? But actually, an older unsolved case. But we do a class on that where agencies, host agencies, actually allow. And there's all kinds of hoops we have to jump through in order to get them everybody comfortable. But they actually allow us to review an older unsolved case. And what we really look at in those is, one, organizing the case, and they have to be 12, 15 or years old or older. And what we're really looking at that is what modern technology could be applied to evidence that was collected. Columbia PD had one in 1990, and technology finally caught up with the evidence collection that was collected. And in 10 years later, in 2000, they end up solving a homicide based on a DNA find. That was the Pritchard case back in that time frame. And that was developed by one of their detectives that was working unsolved, older unsolved cases and was reviewing the evidence. And we were in discussion with him at the college about, you know, what this evidence, that evidence, what was done back in 1990, what could we do in 2000. He resubmitted some evidence to the Highway Patrol Lab, and they were able to do a DNA profile.
And what went behind the decision to partner with your class at Columbia College?
As far as Columbia PD or just in general? There isn't any other college around this area that does that type of class. And due to the fact of my years of service here, I had a good working relationship with chiefs and sheriffs and a sense of trust with that. And they, when originally approached, I had a lot of negative conversations. Well, you're just going to be looking over our shoulder. You're looking for what we did wrong. That wasn't it at all. Once everybody – and we had meetings and discussions before we ever got that class off the ground we're going to see – we're going to organize it. We're going to digitize everything. We're going to hotword everything. Then we're going to see what modern technology can do with evidence that maybe hasn't been submitted or just lying there. And the Pritchard case was one that I gave example of. It was 1990, 2000, DNA finally caught up with the evidence that was collected, and they ended up able to solve that case.
Okay. Well, I guess the thing I'm wondering about is, you know, presumably local law enforcement agencies have this backlog of cases that haven't been solved. And now, as a result of emerging technologies, they can revisit them. Are local law enforcement agencies equipped to do this? Have they enough resources to actually look into these cases?
Well, I can feel that one, and you probably can from the Highway Patrol. But I got a call in the last year. I've gotten two calls from out of state, one from Oklahoma and one from Nevada. And one was family member, one was close friends of a family member, wanting to see, and they got. They found me on the internet because of my class. They just started punching it in, and it pops up. And I was local where these unsolved homicides had taken place, and they wanted me to go back and see if I would review those cases and maybe be part of my class. I subsequently got a hold of the agencies that would have jurisdiction, and we did a lot of preliminary work up on that, but what really bogs it down is the agencies, smaller agencies around here, just don't have the manpower to assign somebody to full-time unsolved cases because of all the new cases that are coming through the door. That there are people in custody, even the labs that way. We submitted evidence in an unsolved case and the case was back in 89, we submitted evidence for a DNA workup, and it took about 2 years for that to get looked at. Through no fault of anybody, just the crime lab is just bogged down with prosecutors needing the evidence for trial or people in custody, that type of thing, where that unsolved case gets, finally worked up. We now have that back, and we know the next steps of evidence we want to submit. But a lot of it's just a manpower issue of having the personnel ability to assign them to work those type of cases and take them away from the armed robberies, the shootings, the homicides that are happening right now.
Okay. Well, do like smaller law enforcement agencies, like what resources do they have to come to revisit those cases? If are there grants that they could apply for? Or
well, you can get, there are grants. To do that. But the way it mostly works is in downtime or in a limited amount of time, they will have a detective review that. That's why our class kind of got popular, is they got free manpower and somebody to organize cases, and then they come in, we bring in the old detectives from those old cases, and they're not there to teach anything. They're there to do a round table with the students, because there's a lot of information in between somebody's ears that never got written that maybe we can plug information in.
Okay. We have a caller right now, Art, from Columbia. Are you there, Art?
Yeah, hi. Actually, I'm in Jefferson City.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Well, do you have a question or a comment?
Yeah, I agree that much of this is very exciting. I was wondering, though, on the flip side, what kind of protections are going to be in place against prosecutorial malfeasance? We haven't really heard so much about DNA or fingerprints, but lately there's been some high-profile reporting of some really outrageous problems with medical examiners and especially in the area of fire investigation, where either through incompetence or deliberate contamination of evidence, people have been unfairly prosecuted. And I just wondered, there's always that flip side with any technology, and I just wondered what plans there were to protect the innocent.
Okay, do you want to take that, Captain Hull?
Well, it's an ongoing process of training the criminalists. As technology comes along, those criminals have to be trained to keep up with that technology. So it's an ongoing process as well as an ongoing process. And we've come a long way in the few years, well, not few years I've been on, but in the many years that I've been on, in the collection of evidence and teaching that in the academies, because there's a good process there where, at that point, it's very important to collect that and package it correctly, or you could ruin your evidence that you have in the case. So each step in the process has to be continuous and has to be to the level where everything, when it's submitted, is how it's supposed to be, how the lab wants to receive it, so they can do the proper analysis on it. So everything, the training has a lot to do with that, keeping that evidence where it's at and keeping the case straight, as he mentioned there, making sure that's a good case.
All right. Well, this might be a good time to bring up the 2009 National Academy of Sciences study, which talked about the need to become up with more standardized protocols within evidence testing. Would you mind telling me about what the study suggested?
Yeah. First of all, it came out with out of a just outcropped from sporadic cases that we hear about. Where things maybe not going in the courtroom as well as they should have. Congress commissioned the National Academies of Science to take the science committee of the NAS to the Science and Technology Committee. I believe that was the committee that was tasked with forming a commission to study the strengths and weaknesses of the forensic science in general and the criminal investigation as well. The commission held their first meeting in 2007. In fact, I was actually able there to testify to the first meeting in Washington, D.C. due to a position I held with American Society of Crime Lab Directors at the time. And the commission was made up of judges, attorneys, academics, statisticians, and several forensic science practitioners. They met over the course of over a year, I believe, developed a document called A Path Forward, with recommendations. And again, it's kind of a cradle to grave approach because it starts with the collection of evidence and the need for standardized best practices adopted by law enforcement agencies. They didn't identify those practices. They just say that, you know, the agencies, you know, it starts with the investigator. They saw they were just identifying gaps. They made some recommendations of standardized testing among all laboratories, accreditation of laboratories and certification of scientists. It's a fairly large, comprehensive document. Many of the other recommendations in that document are addressed through the current accreditation and certification programs that exist today. However, those programs happen to be voluntary in many, many states. I will say in the state of Missouri, about 4 years ago, it did pass legislation requiring that all publicly funded crime laboratories be accredited, and we were the fourth state in the nation to make that requirement. So that's the first step of the quality system, is to make sure your laboratories are accredited. Most of the problems that were highlighted in the study and talked about have occurred in laboratories that have not been accredited by anybody. And so I think that's a very important first step, is to require nationwide all laboratories to become accredited. The certification programs are coming online now for the individual scientists to be certified in their individual disciplines. More and more of our people are becoming certified now. You know, having said that, you know, it's still an operation involving human beings, and the ultimate gatekeeper of this is still going to be the court system. You know, and the judges for years had been the gatekeepers under rulings of Daubert and Frye, where the judge was assigned the role of that. And I think we're going to also see the judicial system kind of pulled into this whole discussion as well. There are training programs for judges. I saw a presentation of one called ASTAR, A-S-T-A-R, and it's a training program to have judges specifically trained in understanding the forensic sciences so that they can properly adjudicate a trial. So, you know, it's not just one single problem. It's really the need to perhaps produce standardization among all steps of the way of the criminal justice process.
Well, to expound upon that, and this really relates, he addressed the lab side of it, and what we've done on the academia side is we've looked at the disciplines that are certifiable by the International Association of Identification, and that's the oldest forensic group in the world. And there's a Missouri division that we have, all states have a division, but there's a Missouri division of the AI. But what we've done, or what I've done in my classes, is I've reviewed the materials at the AI, like texts that they are taking their test questions from, that an individual that wants to get certified as Crime Scene 1 or Crime Scene 2, Crime Scene 3, in accordance with the AI certifications, the text that they have to read from, they're going to be tested from when they take their certification test. What I've done is I've started the process of implementing, say, a text that is required reading by the AI for a police officer to get certified, you know, when it comes to that point in time, is I've integrated it into my classroom text. And that's how I'm going to stay abreast of preparing my students for AI certifications, because a lot of agencies, within X number of years, they have to reach certain certifications after they're hired. Well, what we're designing our classes to bring that student, and we're doing this in law enforcement, like with Jeff Nichols' class. We did the same thing when he designed his. I assisted him in the AI protocols and text, and he built that class based on AI recommendations, again, going back to certification. We're seeing that in order to get on the stand and do some forensic testimony or even just general crime scene testimony, you got to have the certifications to go with that. So if you're going to be testifying about bloodstain reconstruction and that discipline, there has to be a certification of that, which like the AI has that. And so we use materials that the AI approves for their certification process, and we're integrating it into the classroom at the college.
Hmm. Well, outside of academia, has there been any pushback in terms of these new requirements to become certified or to use standardized protocols, just because presumably these agencies have been operating using their own protocols for years, right? And they might be under-resourced, and now this is just an additional hurdle for them.
There's no pullback. When we did that law enforcement class over at LETI back in October, it originally was set up, I think, for 20. It got overbooked. It ended up with 30. We had to cut it off. There's a waiting list, and we had them from all different states, not just Missouri. We had them from Iowa and Arkansas and different states that were coming here because it was based on IAI certification materials. And so there's not a pushback. We had waiting lists. So the agencies from not just here in Columbia or in this area here in Missouri, they saw and appreciated the need to start preparing for certifications and making sure their personnel are there. And that's how that class was based, was upon completion of that evidence course that helped prepare them to now go to the IAI and take that certification exam. So that's how those blended together. And I just took another step down, so to speak, where I've integrated it into my classroom for students that are getting a CJ, a forensic science degree.
Okay. Well, I just want to remind listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Raymond Tungekar. Today, we're talking about crime scene investigations and hearing about some of the ways they've changed over the years. Joining me in studio are Mike Himmel, an adjunct instructor with Columbia College's Criminal Justice Program, and we're also joined by Captain Tim Hall and Bill Marbaker of the Missouri State Highway Patrol. And for you in our audience, are you a fan of programs like CSI? Why or why not? And what do you find appealing about it? You can share your thoughts by giving a call at 573-882-8925 or by emailing intersection@kbia.org. Bill, my understanding is that the Department of Justice is currently working to come up with a federal commission to institute standards at forensic labs across the country.
Yes.
How is that expected to affect your crime lab at the Missouri State Highway Patrol?
I don't see it really having any negative effects whatsoever. Most of the practices, first of all, the commission hasn't even received its charter, exact charter yet. The commission is really an outgrowth of a prior group called Subcommittee on Forensic Science that was formed out of the President's Office of the President as a result of the National Academy's study. Now, the Subcommittee on Forensic Science, which was chaired by an individual from Department of Justice and an individual from NIST, National Institute of Standards and Technology, devised, you know, different sub-subcommittees within that subcommittee. And this, I think, is my understanding, is the work product of that last few years. Now, this National Commission on Forensic Science is currently soliciting applicants. It's going to be comprised of 30 members that will represent a cross-section of the criminal justice system that will include defense attorneys, prosecutors, judges, law enforcement officials, and forensic science practitioners. But it's going to be 30 people. They'll meet four times a year. And basically then my understanding is they're going to rely on specialty groups, which currently exist right now, called scientific working groups, to devise or make recommendations for standardized crime scene investigative techniques and standardized laboratory analysis to be utilized in all laboratories throughout the United States. We hope that they'll come up with a good work product. And in general, my feeling is that we are already there in the accredited laboratories. Maybe one of the gaps is laboratories that are still unaccredited out there, not in Missouri, but, you know, in other states. But I think this is a really good step forward to make standardized procedures that everybody follows. You know, how many, what kind of tests are valid, what kind of tests are not valid. One of the most important things is conveying the significance of associations you make in a laboratory. If you're doing a microscopy, comparing hairs or fibers is one of the concerns is some laboratories may be overstating the significance of associations, and that's something that as an accredited lab we would not be allowed to do. So in addition to just using the same practices laboratory to laboratory, we're going to see consistency in reporting the results of our lab results so that they are clear and not misleading and not subject to interpretation by the judicial system.
Okay. Well, we started out the conversation by talking about, you know, CSI and some misconceptions, but how has new knowledge about forensic science impacted the way that lay people, like non-law enforcement, view evidence, or I guess maybe how has it played out in our legal system, for example, for jurors?
We do have something called the CSI effect.
Yes, we do.
And in some courts, the prosecutors say, they're almost afraid to present a trial without DNA evidence, for example, because the people see that, on TV, and that's what the jurors expect. So the CSI effect has led to some courtroom challenges to try to educate the jury that there are technologies out there besides what they see on TV and criminal investigative techniques that are not necessarily as are portrayed on TV. The CSI effect has had a positive effect on us in terms of the pool of potential applicants wanting to come to work at labs. It's spawned a lot of good forensic science programs around the nation, and we're seeing people once again engage in the sciences. We were getting into a big problem with brain drain in our nation, and we're seeing a large influx now of kids coming out of college with science backgrounds again. So I think that's been a big positive.
Hmm. How much has enrollment increased, or rather interest in these programs? I mean, do you see like an actual effect out as a result of CSI and like those types of programs?
Well, it's increased quite a bit. We've gone from a criminal justice degree to, and that's all we used to offer, to where we were one of the first colleges in the nation to, and there's others, but we were on the forefront to offer a forensic science degree with a biology track or a chemistry track. And so, and now we're, the administration's working on a forensic science, a master's in forensic science. We're building a new science building. And within that science building, we've designed a forensic science classroom where we have a mini lab seated teaching as a normal classroom, and then we've got a simulation room, wall moves, and we can go into a simulation room where we can actually do hands-on practical applications of blood stain reconstructions, trajectory reconstruction, like bullet trajectory reconstructions. So we've seen those type of impacts that it's gotten so important. We've actually split away. If you're going to be a police officer, you go get a CJ degree, criminal justice degree. If you're going to want to go to the lab, going to get a chemistry degree or forensic science backup on that, or vice versa, or biology. But forensics has become so important, you've actually seen the criminal justice concept split to where you actually have a criminal justice degree and a forensic science degree directed for those that want to be, say, a criminalist or an ID officer for a department or eventually go to work for a crime lab. Your people going after the forensic science degrees are looking at civilian evidence tech jobs around the nation or working at crime labs. So we've actually seen that's a positive effect. You still have those who want to be a police officer. Now we have those that want to work in forensics. And so I like that concept.
Okay. Well, that new interest is, that is a positive. Are there any like negative effects of the CSI effect? I mean, do lay people, for example, think that they can solve a crime?
Right. I'm sure victims of crime are probably influenced by that when they expect the crime to be solved in 43 minutes, and it doesn't always happen that way. I think generally now, once we're past all the CSI euphoria that swept the planet, 10 years ago or however long it's been on, I think people are finally understanding and they realize that, that these people are actors and they're not, one Sunday or one evening, the actor will be specializing in trace evidence. The next week, he'll be specializing in firearms identification, and they're carrying badges and guns and arresting people and solving it. And that's, I think they understand the entertainment.
In 35 years of working forensics or crime scene, I've interviewed one murder suspect. And I hardly ever carried a gun because that wasn't my assignment. I was working crime scene. So it's nothing like that on TV. My wife was watching one of the CSI shows on TV, and and you know, with the people working the crime scene in stiletto heels and I, you know, fancy $3,000 suits. And she asked us, did you ever have a partner that looked like that? And I said, darling, I love you dearly, but if I did, I wouldn't have retired. But it's a TV show, and I think you're correct. People have figured out that. For the majority, I figured out it's a TV show. It's entertainment. But we still have juries sometimes without that that have that CSI mentality. They have a higher expectation because of the technology that's out there. If they don't see it or hear it, then they wonder what's wrong.
Okay. You know? Well, we only have about 2 minutes left, but I just thought we can close the show by talking about, you know, why someone would be drawn to this profession. I was talking with Jeff earlier, and he mentioned that, you know, the depictions on CSI are actually more glamorous than it actually is. It's what he was doing was well, let's just say some of the scenes he was at were pretty gritty. So I guess just briefly, can we go around the table and talk about what the profession offers you?
Well, what I tell my students and what I thought is, as an evidence tech, you're the last living person in this world that can communicate with the deceased. Not in a morbid sense, but to can communicate and bring justice to their loss, and what greater loss is it than your life? And that's why we have to bring our A game to the table every time we go to the crime scene. We can't, you know, a 300 hitter gets a $1 million contract in baseball. We can't hit 300. We got to hit 1,000 every time we go to the plate. So we have to be prepared to give our best effort. So,
yeah. What drew me to this profession was. You know, all my life I had just a general interest in law enforcement, but it wasn't the compelling interest, you know, to drive me directly toward that career. I always had an interest in the sciences, and starting in the eighth grade is when I really got interested in chemistry. Through high school, more into chemistry, especially since the chemistry teacher was also the hockey coach, and I was wanting to stay in good graces with the hockey coach because I was on the team. But in college, it just, you know, I just fell into the chemistry, but I never lost my passion for the law enforcement thing. You know, I read a lot of, you know, novels and I watched a lot of television, you know, maybe fell prey to CSI myself a little bit, but, you know, in its earlier years. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I got with my chemistry degree in hand, I say, you know, do I want to just do quality control on paint samples at a paint factory all my life, or do I want to do something that's going to make a difference? And I learned about this profession and pursued it, and it's been almost 30, it'll be 35 years in July.
Okay, and Captain Hall, we just have a couple seconds left.
Okay, that's, I think it's just a challenge of being able to, somebody that's, you know, it's in a lab that's had really no contact with the scene or the victim, being able to take that challenge and try and help us, you know, find out who committed this crime and solve that crime and take it all the way to the end, to the final part in court.
Okay, and we'll have to leave it at that. That's it for today's Intersection. Thanks to our guests, Mike Himmel, Tim Hall, and Bill Marbaker of the Missouri State Highway Patrol. And thanks to Jeff Nichols, who joined the first half of the show. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. You can watch live streaming video of our program each Monday afternoon online at kbia.org. Along that video, you can submit your questions and comments and participate in an online discussion with others in the audience. Today's program was produced by Janet Saidi and Vanita Rizvik. Travis McMillan is our director with production assistance from Eric Stazak. Katie Moritz and Jessica Reese also provided production assistance. Pat Akers was our audio producer. Executive directors are Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. I'm Raymond Tongakar. Thanks for joining us today, and have a great week.